I'm pretty sure they will pivot at some point, but I suspect it's farther down the track than people believe. And the period of market participants going from absolute certainty that the pivot's coming to they're serious about remaining elevated for as long as they can, that period is where the kind of potential volatility lies as markets adjust price levels to reflect higher interest rates for longer. So I think that's where we are.
Welcome to Wealthion. I'm Wealthion founder Adam Taggart. It's a very challenging and confusing time for investors as there are several standoffs happening right now, and it's uncertain which parties will emerge victorious. For starters, the market clearly doesn't believe Jerome Powell's resolution to hold the federal funds rate above 5% for the rest of the year. It's currently predicting a Fed pivot by summer. On top of that, the market's been in rally mode and is now trying to confirm the recent bullish breakout. But nearly all of the recent macro data shows a weakening economy. Which outcomes are more likely to prevail? To help us tackle the probabilities, we're fortunate to welcome macro analyst and interviewer extraordinaire Grant Williams back to the program. Grant, thanks so much for joining us today.
Hi, mate. As always, a great pleasure to see you. It's a very spiffy haircut you've got there.
Yeah, thanks. Well, it's straight from the shower. All right, buddy. Well, look, thanks so much for joining us today. Lots to get into with you. You're one of my favorite people to interview, Grant. But let me kick it off with the usual high-level opening that we start these with. What's your current assessment of the global economy and financial markets?
That's a hell of a question. Look, I think it's important to understand that there are times when you can say, I have no idea, right? And that's where we are. We're still waiting for the answer to that question to emerge, and it is stubbornly refusing to do so. You know, we've got so much conflicting data. We've got so much conviction on the side of markets that the Fed is going to pivot. They're going to go straight from QT to QE, and they are trading accordingly. On the other side of the coin, we've got, you know, all kinds of data sending us different signals. You know, we can interpret any which way we want. The yield curve sending one thing, the jobless data sending another message. And I think everybody is kind of in this period where we've all kind of stuck a tent pole in the ground and said, okay, this is what I think is going to happen. And most people seem to think that it's going to be a Fed pivot pretty soon. But you can't really have any conviction unless you just say, well, the data doesn't matter. I have absolute conviction that the data's wrong and I'm right, and therefore I'm going to stick with it. So I think smart investors right now are keeping a very, very open mind and understanding that literally any outcome is on the table here right now. The Fed are desperately trying to convince us that they are not going to go straight into a pivot and start cutting rates, but they're going to hold rates higher for longer. And there's an enormous amount of hot air being expended to try and convince people that's what's going to happen. And I really do believe that's what they want, intend, and believe is the right thing to do. I think they're trying desperately to sow the seeds of that in markets so that people understand that's where we're going to be. Now, that's not to say they won't pivot, because as we've seen over the years and markets have been conditioned to believe is that at the first sign of trouble, they'll pivot. But of course, every single one of those pivots has purely been a market phenomenon. There has not been any inflation on the back end of it to stop them pivoting. So they've seen weakness in asset prices and they've pivoted. And so, you know, we've all become convinced of believing that's how this wash, rinse, repeat cycle turns. But, you know, again, I keep harping on this and have done for the last year, this return of inflation, even if you think it's going to go away pretty quickly, it changes everything because it means they can't pivot just because asset prices start to wobble. So the simple truth is I don't know what they're going to do. I'm pretty sure they will pivot at some point, but I suspect it's farther down the track than people believe. And the period of market participants going from absolute certainty that the pivot's coming to they're serious about remaining elevated for as long as they can, that period is where the kind of potential volatility lies as markets adjust price levels to reflect higher interest rates for longer. So I think that's where we are. I don't think anyone can give you conclusive data about the economic picture, because it's all over the place. You know, every time we get gangbuster figures, like employment numbers, for example, you know, friends like our mutual friend Steph Pomboy will pick that apart with a scalpel and demonstrate right. very easily and very quickly why it's a massive, massive mistake to rely on that number. So, you know, long story short, remain open-minded, remain fleet, remain flexible, and be prepared for the first time in a long time, I think, to challenge that belief that at the first sign of trouble, the Fed will pivot.
All right. Great, great first answer. Lots to dig into there. What's so interesting to me is, like, as I see it, it sounds like maybe you see it the same way. The market is not believing the Fed when the Fed says, look, we're gonna hike higher and remain there for longer. But it's believing the Fed when the Fed is saying, but we're gonna engineer a soft landing, right? It's kind of like picking and choosing. It's kind of like hearing what it wants to hear, yeah. sort of the way yeah. I interpret it here. And we'll pick all that apart. Staying at a real high level for a second, Grant, one of the reasons why I love to interview you is, like me, just better, you interview a lot of other great minds in the macro world. And, you know, I think your podcast is the gold standard for these type of long form macro interviews, Grant. And you are in a relatively unique position to talk to all these minds and then synthesize what you hear, right? And try to, you know, pick and choose what resonates most with you and come up with your worldview. And I'm just curious, you know, based on all those conversations, what do you see as like the big trends we need to pay attention to coming into this year?
Well, again, you know, I think what's been really interesting over the last 6 months, certainly, is the number of people, you know, really smart guys who I have a tremendous amount of respect for, who will almost laugh and make a joke out of the fact that they'll say, I've got no idea what happens next. You know,
I've had a number of guys say this is like the most challenging macro environment they've seen in their lives, in their careers.
Exactly. And I think that is one of the most crucial things for everybody to be ready and willing to do is say, I don't know, because we've been conditioned to become certain about so many things. And there's been a reason for that, as we touched upon in the answer to the first question. You know, we've been conditioned and reconditioned and reconditioned over the years to expect certain things to happen when certain conditions manifest themselves. And over again, we've had that reinforced. And that's why now people are refusing to believe the Fed about staying high and believing the Fed when they say they're going to engineer a soft landing. But, you know, as I said in one of my recent presentations, that's the world as we wish it to be, but we have to invest in the world as it is. And for the longest time, the world as we wish it to be and the world as it is have kind of merged. And so you've had this beautiful period where you knew that asset prices were going to go higher, you knew that rates were going to stay low, you knew that liquidity was going to be abundant, and you knew that the first sign of trouble, the Fed had no problem stepping in. And that was just a wonderful place to be. And so
and
now
you could borrow cheaply to leverage that ride too.
Exactly right. Yeah. I mean, all the things that come with zero cost of capital are tailwinds to asset prices, pure and simple. But now here we are, that's gone. And we've got, you know, while we may not have positive real rates, we have a really good pay me to sit and wait rate of, you know, 4.5%, give or take. And that changes things. And so, you know, along with that tailwind that I talked about, we've seen this enormous move towards passive allocation and the rise of passive in terms of a place where people are going to put their capital, and also the effect that passive has had on markets, which has been, as Mike Green says, you know, if you give me money, I will invest it. So that, again, as we've seen that money come in, it doesn't sit around and wait for a good entry point. It gets put to work right away. And that's been another tailwind for markets. Now we're in a period where the professional investor, to kind of put a cute term around someone that just kind of does this and has done this for some period of time, is going to be challenged by the volatility you've just spoken about, the uncertainty that you've spoken about. And there's a reason all those guys you're talking to are saying the same thing. We just don't know what's going to happen next, and it's going to be a challenging environment, because it is. And the kind of turmoil that inflation brings with the rising rates, the the change of all the ways that we've been inclined to invest. We're right in that kind of whirlpool right now. We haven't been spat out of it yet. So I think smart investors are, as I said before, open-minded. And I think that's, it's so important, because not just in our investments, but in everything around us, in social media, in our interactions with friends, everybody is so dogmatic about everything now. And this ability to change your mind is being reinforced as a weakness, when in fact, in the period we're about to go into, it's going to be an incredible strength to be able to take a view, position accordingly, and say, I'm wrong, I'm out. That is going to be one of the key attributes to possess in the next few years. And it's why I think active managers and, you know, people with tenure in these markets will likely outperform in the next several years, where they haven't perhaps in the last few, because we've had this rising tide lifting all boats.
Right, right. Great point. And, you know, we have endorsed financial advisors that come on this program every week. We'll have them come on after this interview. You know, they give people context, not only to what the markets are doing kind of on a week-to-week basis, but also they give insight into what an active manager is thinking in this type of environment here. And Lance Roberts, who's leads one of the firms, he's called this year of the audible, where, you know, you have to be, you know, using an analogy from football, we just watched the Super Bowl last night, you know, where you're going to have to, you know, come up with your battle plan, but you're going to have to be very sensitive to how the developments on the ground are shaking out in real time, and be prepared, like you said, to say, hey, you know what, I thought it was going to go this way, it's now looking like it's going this way, I got to readjust my strategy here.
I think that's right, and I think it's really good advice. And the other thing I would say is, you know, I've fought manfully over the last several years to not become another one of those guys that tells you, hey, you should buy this stock, or you should do this, because there's so many people out there that are happy to offer stock tips and give you specific trading advice and say, hey, I'm buying this, I'm selling that, and that's great, and it's been a really good environment to do that. But I think now more than ever, you know, it becomes about the hows and the whys of what we do, not the what. And I think for people at home watching this, the days when you could hear someone suggest a stock tip or go out and buy an ETF and just wait and expect it to go up are gone. I honestly believe that they're gone, certainly for the foreseeable future. And so I think it's really important to understand how to trade and why to trade and not what to trade. I think the what is a really easy and in many cases very lazy solution. You know, just fast forward to the end of any conversation like this and wait for the stock recommendations, right? And there's been a degree of success in that. But more and more, I think, as we go forward and the people who make those recommendations are forced to pivot and change and cut positions they thought were good because the data changes and the, you know, these tides that we talk about coming to a confluence change the way they have to position themselves, it's going to be very dangerous to just ask someone, what should I buy? And I think it's really important for people to understand that. I think that's one of the big changes now, is that people out there giving trading advice and stock tips, if you're listening to them casually and you don't subscribe to people's service, and you don't follow everything they write about that particular position once you've taken it on, I think you're at a very serious risk of them saying to their subscribers or their customers or their clients or their investors, we were wrong about that. We've cut it. We've moved on. We've gone short this thing that we bought because something's changed. So I've tried very hard not to go down that road for the longest time. And I think it's really, really important that people understand how complicated things are right now and don't fall back to relying upon someone to tell them what to do. Try and learn how and why.
So it's a great point. Now I want to continue my sports analogy here, which is because of the environment that we've had, I mean, really for much of the new millennium, you know, as briefly punctured by the dot-com bubble and then the great financial crisis, it has been easy. There's been a big tailwind at investors' backs. And certainly since 2010, you know, through 2021, I mean, it was really easy. It was almost predictable, right? The market's going to go up, you know, year after year after year, and I can buy the dip and I can remain long and all that stuff, right? And so you develop a musculature, right? You develop a neural wiring for that type of market. And so I think a lot of investors, a lot of kind of casual individual investors, you know, John Hussman says, bubble markets force you to make a choice to look like an idiot now or look like an idiot later, right? So they all felt like they were geniuses, right? Oh, I'm just throwing money at ETFs and they're all going up. Look how easy this is. I'm great. And honestly, most professional investors, I think, developed that muscular too. Most financial advisors did. And so, and I believe I've heard you say this before, and it's a little self-serving of me to ask this question, but I believe in this type of market, you feel like unless you are an experienced investor and are aware of all the things we're talking about and have already developed this musculature, you're probably better off picking one of the advisors who has the long-term experience, has a process in place to be able to be nimble like this. And therefore, the picking of the advisor almost becomes more important than the picking of any particular stock or ETF at this point.
Yeah, it does. And that's not to say that people can't do this themselves and learn on the hoof. You absolutely can. And in fact, learning through the pain of getting stuff wrong is the best way to learn, because you tend not to make those mistakes.
That's how you learn the lessons, yeah.
But I think it's important to understand you don't just put all your chips in now. You know, start to, if you want to try and figure this out yourself and manage this and trade the swings that you're going to see, do it with money that you won't lose sleep over if it goes wrong, because it will go wrong. It doesn't mean you don't come out the end ahead. But between here and wherever the end might be for you, you will have all kinds of mental anguish to deal with, because that's the kind of markets we're going to be in. And so, you know, I think that your point about the advisor is important. But what's more important than that, I think, before you even get to the act of choosing an advisor, is understanding what are my goals, you know, because I've spoken about this again in presentations I've done recently. If you've been invested in markets for the last 10 years, you got rich, right? You made a really good amount of money. If you just sat there and you had it in the markets, you've made some really good money. And now it's time to switch that mindset around and go, okay, I made money in arguably the easiest market of my lifetime. And that's good. I should have made money during that period. Everybody that was invested should have made good money during this period. Now, potentially I'm going into one of the hardest periods of my lifetime. I don't know what it looks like, but there's a lot of really smart people who've been around for decades doing these things, warning me that this next period is not going to be like that. It's going to be much trickier. My key focus now is I don't want to give back the money I made, because it was really easy to make it. It sucks to lose it, and making it again is way, way, way harder. So shifting that mindset from offense to defense, you know, if you want to continue this sporting analogy, you know, when in the Super Bowl, it's easy, right? The other side has the ball, you switch to defense. Mm-hmm. It's very, very straightforward. And then when, you know, four and out, or they punt it away, you bring your offense team on. It's great. There's a signal, you know when to do that. We don't have such a luxury apart from, say, listening to people. Let's pick Jeremy Grantham for a perfect example, right? Jeremy is one of the most brilliant investors of his generation. And we've reached that point in the cycle where people have been kind of calling him out, saying he's way too bearish, blah, blah, blah. But Jeremy hasn't just been investing for the last 10 years, right? Jeremy's been investing for the last 50 years.
Exactly.
And over that time, he's invested through all different types of environments, all different types of cycles. And this last 10 years, okay, so that hasn't suited Jeremy, because it's just been, no matter how hard you analyze the market, the tidal wave of liquidity and the effect of negative interest rates have just pushed everything higher. Whether it should have gone higher or not, the way Jeremy's learned to invest over the years have not served him well for this last 10 years. So if you put money with Jeremy 10 years ago, you probably would be unhappy with the performance relative to benchmarks. But if you put money with Jeremy 40 years ago, you're going to be very pleased. And if you put money with Jeremy now, saying, I want you to have it for the next 25 years or until I retire, I'm willing to bet that over the course of that cycle, you're going to be very pleased. And, you know, Jeremy's talking about markets, these markets going sideways for 10 years. You know, that's not bearish per se, calling for a crash. But if you can imagine the markets going sideways for 10 years, and at the end of it, if you just put money in an index fund, you're where you started, that's not good in an age of, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8% inflation. And let's say it moderates, but if we have elevated inflation and your real returns are negative, that's no good. Now, in that 10-year period, if you are adept and flexible and adroit, there will be times where you can make some really good returns. But the kind of buy and hold strategy and relying on markets to just keep going up is done. So you're going to have to pick the sectors you want to be in for the right reasons. You've got to be right about them and the market believing it at the same time as you and causing those to go right. And then you've got to figure out, okay, how do I exit? And you know, a good friend of mine, Lee Robinson, who I interviewed in the very early days of Real Vision, super, super guy, really smart investor, very, very savvy man. You know, I asked him, I said, what's the difference between professional investors and amateur or retail investors? What's the key difference? And I'll never forget what he said to me. He said, professional investors know how to sell stocks, how to exit positions. And he's absolutely right. Because this idea that you get something right and it's going well for you, there is still a time to exit. And if we do have kind of choppy markets that go sideways, you better get those entry and exit points right if you're going to make any money. Otherwise, you're going to just ride this horse to the end of the thing and be back at the starting line again and have inflation eat some of that away in the meantime. And of course, the flip side of that is there are going to be plenty of opportunities to lose a lot of money in between now and then. So it becomes a time to, getting back to your question about the advisor, understand what your goals are and then find an advisor whose trading style and experience will help you achieve that goal. And for me, I think the most sensible goal right now is to pare back your expected return profile and concentrate much more on the defensive side of the ball and say, okay, I'm up whatever, 50% over the last 3 years, despite there being a global pandemic. That's not because I'm a brilliant trader. That's because governments around the world threw multiple tens of trillions of dollars at this market. That's why I'm up 50%. It's not because I'm a genius. Now, the next 5 years, if I can hang on to that 50% gain I made, fantastic. If I can make that 50% over a 10-year period instead of a 3-year, 4-year period, it doesn't matter. That's still a really good return.
Right.
I just don't want to give it back.
All right. Great, great insight. It's funny. We sort of flipped my interview script here and got to the stuff at the end earlier on, but that's great. If we can, I want to jump back to the macro for a second. And we're going to talk probabilities here, Grant. So not going to hold you to any of this. You're welcome to come back on at any time and say, hey, you know, I thought X, I'm now think Y, right? We'll let you call your own audibles. But I'd love to get your general sense on where you, Grant Williams, the macro analyst, think things may be headed. And of course, you know, caveating all this from what we said earlier, highly uncertain time. You know, again, we're just talking best probabilities as we understand the data right now. So why don't we start with inflation? Because you rightly said that really has changed the game here for the central banks, right? They no longer can act with impunity. There is now another bully on the playground that, can punch back if it doesn't like what the Fed's doing. So I think it's safe to say we're now in a period of disinflation, right? That inflation peaked, I think, last June, at least here in the States. It's coming down, still a little TBD on how fast it's going to come down this year. I think you'll see people argue both sides of that equation, but the trajectory seems to be down at this point. How big of a factor do you see inflation being this year? Do you expect it to be a little bit more stubborn? Or maybe like our good friend Stephanie Pomboy, are we understandably worried about inflation because it's the dragon staring us in the face right now? But should we actually be more worried about the deflationary dragon that may be arriving soon?
Look, and the answer is both, right? The answer is both, and it's the sequencing that's so tricky. And this is a big change. We've had deflation has been the only thing we've had to worry about for the longest time, and so inflation was never a concern. And even though the numbers just from base effects are going to drop, we're not seeing that in the real world. We're still seeing, in the UK, it's like 1976 all over again. Everybody's striking for more wages. The fact that inflation moderates and prices are going up slower than they were last year is, not really the solution to the problem, right? Because people their cost of living has gone up 10% over the last year, and that's the headline figure. It's actually far more than that. But okay, the good news is, celebrate, it's only going to go up 5% next year. Well, it doesn't matter, because this is cumulative in a real world sense.
Right.
So even though you might get a lower CPI number, it doesn't really help people, because they've had this big shock to their kind of own balance sheet over the last year. And people are now trying to figure that out. And of course, what they're doing to try and repair that problem is go to their employer and say, hey, you need to pay us more wages. And of course, the employers are going to look at the CPI coming down and go, well, look, inflation's only 2%. So that, you know, we'll give you a 1% pay rise, or we'll give you a 1.5% pay rise, and they'll come around the negotiating table. But you know the answer already, right? They're going to be nonsense. Here's my grocery bill. This is my cost of living. You can say what you like. And suddenly those numbers that were really convenient for everybody to believe the headlines, in a real world situation where families have had this massive shock to their standard of living, suddenly they don't just listen to the CPI anymore and blindly go, oh, well, great, my cost of living has come down, because their mindset shifted. Every time they go to the grocery store, they're looking and saying, geez, eggs are how much now? Milk's how much now? So absolutely, the numbers are going to come down. And Steph makes a great case as to why headline CPIs could be 2% by June. I don't know if it'll get down that low, but it absolutely could. The question is, does it matter? And can you sound some kind of all clear? So I'm much more worried about the inflationary problem returning. And I think the Fed is too, to be honest. I think they know they have a playbook for deflation. I don't think they're worried about that, because they've had through 15 years of experience. Oh, if deflation, then XY, cut rates, yeah. QE.
And if I just interject that yeah. Powell actually said that in his press conference from right. 2 weeks ago, or whatever, where he basically said, I'm willing to err on the side of over tightening here, because if we create some issues there, we know how to fix those.
Look, exactly. And markets know what to expect. This kind of learned behavior is everywhere. And look, one day it won't work. And one day they'll pull out the, you know, deflationary playbook, and it won't work, because inflation is too entrenched and people start to react differently to different stimuli. So, you know, it's for me, I'm more worried about inflation, because if deflation returns, yes, we know the problems it creates, and we know that there are things they can do. But if they do cut too soon and inflation comes back with a vengeance, which it might well do that, I think that's a much bigger problem. So I hope Steph is right, but I think you have to prepare for inflation and the problems that brings, because that's, at this point, is a much bigger threat, I think, in the short term to global markets and stability, particularly on a social level, than deflation is right now.
All right. So on inflation, you know, we had a lot of central bank liquidity in the years leading up to the pandemic that didn't really create inflation, at least as measured by the CPI, right? We kept hearing people like Janet Yellen saying their concern was we didn't have enough inflation, right?
Yeah.
And so it seems that what really changed the game was, yes, the supply chain breakages that the pandemic created, which are mostly, you know, under control at this point in time. But it was the trillions and trillions of fiscal stimulus around the world, right? So if the Fed were to pivot this year, I guess my question is just how inflationary would that really be, since the Fed, you know, doing all of its stimulating beforehand didn't seem to really goose the CPI that much.
Well, there's one other thing that I think we need to factor into this, and it's a really important one. A big change since the last time, and that is whether you want to call it the end of globalization, or you want to call it the decline of globalization, or you want to call it the rise of reshoring, whatever it may be.
Yep.
We are clearly in a period where the kind of global community is fraying at the edges, and tensions are rising in just about every direction. And there is stress from the Middle East in every direction. There is stress from the US in every direction. There's stress from China, Russia. You know, we are in a very different world now than we were pre-pandemic. And so this idea that supply chains are the problem, the idea of being forced to secure supply lines, and you can point to any number of quarterly earnings calls and listen to CEOs talk about how huge a priority that is for them, securing supply chains and and getting control in friendly countries, and onshoring where they can, that is a guarantee of higher costs, because all the cheap places to produce goods and assemble them have been milked dry. So this is a reality that people are going to have to face, right? If you want security of your supply chain, if you want security of your fabrication of or assembly of products, you're going to have to pay more. It's that simple. And so will consumers pay more? And if consumers either won't or can't pay more, what does that mean for margins? So we're in a very different world now. So just saying, well, pre-pandemic, they juiced the market. It didn't have any effect. Pandemic's gone. Supply chains are kind of normalizing. Therefore, we're back in that world. We're not. It's just not that simple. We're in a very, very different world. And look, we don't know yet if this is going to be a huge problem or a manageable problem or not a problem at all. You know, I would put a very low probability on it being no problem at all. Mm-hmm. But we have to understand that this new world and these new conditions that really kind of pervade every single part of every supply chain on the planet, more or less, have yet to reveal to us how they're going to impact either companies' decisions about manufacturing, the ability to pass prices on, consumers' willingness to pay higher prices. We just don't know. And so that's a really big risk for me. Again, we come back to this idea of risk and probability. I think it's a really big risk to assume, okay, I'm going to bet that we go back to how we were. And if they pivot, it's going to have the same effect it did before all this stuff happened.
Yeah. And I'm going to talk more about that in just a moment. But the market seems to have this faith that, oh, we pivot and then we're back to the 2010 through 2021 salad days, right? Ignoring for the moment that if the Fed pivots because it is forced to pivot, those are probably not going to be conditions that are going to be bullish for stocks, right?
No, look, exactly right. And they've already told you that they will pivot as late as they possibly can. They've told you that we want to stay higher for longer. They've done everything in their power to convince you that we're going to get to whatever the terminal rate may be. Markets are pricing it, you know, above 5% now, and we're going to hold it there. And Christ, even Neil Kashkari is saying that. So you know they're serious about wanting to stay there. So yeah, think about what it will take for them to undo all of that hard work to publicly do an about turn on what they promised you they were going to do. What it would take for them to do that now is significant. And again, you know, look, let's say you prepare for a much more volatile, much trickier environment, and you prepare for them not to pivot, and you prepare for them to not go back to cutting rates and QE and all these things. Let's say you prepare for that and you're wrong. That's the easiest you're going to get it, right? If they do pivot and everything starts going, that's the easiest you're going to be. If you assume that they're going to do that and everything's going to go up and you position yourself accordingly and you're wrong in that direction, it's going to be hell on earth for you to get your portfolio right again. So again, you know, understand, what if I'm wrong? Where's my biggest margin to be wrong? And I would argue your biggest margin to be wrong is to assume things are going to be trickier for longer. And then if we get all the conditions we saw, and it's obvious that, hey, we're back in this Goldilocks period where everything's going to go up, really simple. Because I'm not saying you need to go short now. I'm saying play defense. It's really easy to go from defense, i.e. I'm going to be neutral, I'm going to prepare for inflation, I'm going to have inflation sensitive positioning my portfolio, to offense, right, green light, let's go. If I'm talking about playing offense on the short side, that's a whole different world. But that, again, is not something that the average investor should be doing. It's not a time, even short sellers aren't being aggressive on the short side. They're waiting for signs that it's safe to take an aggressive positioning on the short side. So, you know, that's where we are. And where can I afford to be wrong? And I would argue, if you being wrong means they're back to easy money and markets are benign and everything's going up, that's a one-day job to turn your portfolio right.
Exactly. It's a low cost of being wrong, because you can absolutely pivot pretty quickly personally. But yeah, if you're wrong the other way and all of a sudden your portfolio is down 30%, you know, and you don't know what's going
to
happen next.
It's not easy to get it back.
Yeah, much worse. Okay, great, great point. Back on so your concerns about inflation are less, I'm not saying they're not at all, factoring in a central bank policy or fiscal policy issue created that could be inflationary. But you're more concerned about the sort of secular new benchmark that we're at, higher benchmark that we're at in terms of just a higher cost world. And where I'm going with this is we now have higher input costs that may be, again, at a higher baseline going forward. We certainly right now have a higher cost of capital, right? So we have and a higher cost of living and real wages that aren't increasing, right? And at least in the US, at least they've been going down, I think 21 straight months from here, right? So we have the consumer getting increasingly squeezed, right? And we have a country or an economy that is almost 70% driven by consumer spending, right? So that's the risk here. The consumer gets squeezed, all that spending potentially gets squeezed. Corporations are having the same issue, right? Their input costs are higher. Workers are now demanding higher wages, right? And consumer demand is softening. And of course, the softening of consumer demand is Jerome Powell's playbook right now, right? That's what he's trying to engineer here. So you kind of have this unstoppable force hitting the immovable object effect here, right? Where you were saying, you know, consumers are saying, look, I can't make it. Employer, you got to pay me more. Where at the same time, the employer is saying, like, pay you more, like my margins are getting squeezed here. Right. Like, I can't do that. Right. So are you as concerned as I think I'm showing my cards here, but as I am about sort of where we're headed right now with this trajectory?
Yeah, look, I think you have to be concerned. But, you know, when we talk about macro events and the last 10 years has been this kind of nirvana for people who love sitting and thinking about everything that's going on and trying to work out what it all means and the big macro pictures and how do I translate that into an investment thesis. And there's been so much to get your teeth into and try and figure out. But to me now, you know, when you ask what I'm worried about my portfolio, period. That's it. I'm not worried about, okay, well, what do I think is going to happen? And if so, how do I position? I'm looking at myself and say, okay, what can hurt me? What can protect me? And what do I need to do to give myself the best chance of surviving this next period, however long it may be? I may decide after a year, okay, I think that was it, and I'm ready to keep this analogy going, play offense again. I'm not so worried about figuring out the macro picture and working out, okay, well, if what's it going to take for Jay Powell to change his mind? I don't need to think about those things right now. I just need to look at the world around me, the problems that I'm facing, and whether my portfolio is set up to help me mitigate those problems. Not right. to provide me with a big return. Is my portfolio going to insulate me from the problems that could confiscate some of those gains I've made?
Great. And the reason why I asked the question I did is because I think for many viewers,
I'm sorry, I answered that, Adam. Sorry, mate. I may have wandered off topic there a bit.
No. It's a good point. But so one of the factors that could threaten the financial wealth of many of the viewers here is getting laid off, right?
Yeah.
And so when I see those two forces happening, where the consumer, the worker saying, "Look, you got to pay me more. I'm." Drowning here, right? And the employer saying, like, pay you more. Like, I don't know if I can keep you, right? You know, do we and of course in the context, we're seeing slowing economic growth and whatnot, right? Which just suggests that margins will probably compress further going forward, or earnings will at least be lower. So I see this potential recession coming, which then can have these knock-on effects of, yeah, that lower earnings will probably bring stock prices down, which is going to hurt my portfolio. But Jesus, if I lose my income, that's like a DEFCON 1 threat. And maybe at the same time, we haven't even talked about housing yet, but like my house is all of a sudden starting to lose substantial amount of value too. And for a lot of people, that's their biggest asset. So feel free to react to that in any way you like, but it's in this theme of like, yeah, you're trying to manage the immediate threats. There's a whole bunch packed into that statement right there.
No, but I think it's an important one. And you know, what I'm hearing as you say that is exactly what I think, is that we've gone from a macro level to a micro level. And so nothing you said there really is about, okay, what do the central banks do? What's the interest rate policy? It's okay, let's start from the bottom up. My own balance sheet, my income, my house, my spending patterns. And that's the big shift, I think, for people to think about, is the luxury of trying to come up with this great worldview and then find a way to make money out of trends like demographics or technology or all these things, they're still there and you can still do that. But making that the core of your portfolio now, I think, is a very dangerous thing to do. I think everything you've just laid out there is exactly right. And that's what people need to think about. How do I protect myself against losing my income? Have I got too much leverage on my house? Should I pay some of that down? Have I got the lowest fixed rate I can get on my house? I need to be alert if rates do come down, even if it's for a short period of time, I need to be ready to refinance lower when and if I can. You know, all these things to go into defense mode and protect ourselves from what's a very uncertain future now is the way to be thinking. It's not about what does the trade war with China mean for my portfolio? Because ultimately, by the time you figure out what that means and you translate it through all the different levels down to your ETF holdings, you've wasted I don't know how much time. When if you start at the bottom and go, okay, what are the problems I'm facing now? It's rising cost of living. It's a falling housing market. Do I need to rein in my spending? Blah, blah, blah. Start with that now. Turn everything on its head, because when you go from deflation to inflation, everything turns on its head. And we need to be able to do that as investors and start from, you know, the checkbook up into the investment thesis rather than coming down.
The base of the Maslow's hierarchy of needs in terms
Right. And that, you know, and this idea of needs is an important one, because we are going into a period where you have to prioritize needs rather than what you want. I mean, and we've had this glorious period where, well, yeah, what do I want? What would I like? I'd like a second home. Well, great. I can get cheap financing. I can afford to pay that. I'm going to get myself a second home. I want a jet ski. Great. I can finance that for 5 years at zero. I'll get myself a jet ski. So we've gone from this period of what do I want to now this next little period is what do I need, right? I need a roof over my head. I need food in my stomach. I need my kids' school fees paid. I need, you know, whatever it is I need. And if you get into that mode about what do I need, you'll find the world looks very, very different. And protecting those needs, you know, you talk about the hierarchy of needs, protecting those is suddenly way more important than, oh, if I get long Tesla options, I'll be able to buy myself a new Tesla. Right? Right. It's not as important anymore. That's all.
So it's so interesting because, of course, you know, this is exactly what every viewer should do here, right? Is really like focus first on getting their house in order before thinking about, okay, great, how do I come up with some great speculative investing strategy here, right? And I think just sort of like they say, there's no atheists in foxholes, right? Like when the pressure comes on, everybody sort of has this retrenchment that you're talking about, right? And you want to figure it out sooner rather than later, right? You want to figure it out in your terms proactively, as opposed to having it forced on you by, you know, by crisis. If enough people start thinking this way, then there actually are some interesting dynamics that I think we do need to predict out, right? So for example, like let's take housing right now. I think in a lot of markets, here in the US at least, transactions have plummeted, right? Sales have crashed. And yes, prices are beginning to come down in certain markets. But right now, in many cases, it's kind of like a standoff, right? Where the sellers don't want to sell. Right. Yeah. They don't want to start locking in these lower prices. Yeah, they're trying to keep what they had. Right. And there's, you know, sort of this attempt at solidarity, like, okay, if none of us sells, right, nobody sets a new price. Right. But at some point when people get worried enough about where things are going, especially if, you know what, I'm an older, you know, boomer, and, you know, I'm kind of looking at the equity in my house as kind of my retirement. If I think that's going to start coming down, well, then I want to sell early. Right? Because if prices are going to start cascading down, I want to get 90% of my equity, not 65% of it. Right. Sure. And so there are going to be sort of trends like this as the herd begins to bolt. Right. I find that interesting. Also, maybe on the just on consumer spending, you're a big fan of
one point about housing thing. Just because it's interesting what you said there about the boomer in the house, right? Because that's exactly the thought process, right? I've got this house. It's got my equity in it. I want to get out. 5 years ago, their thought would have been, what's the housing market going to do? Not my house.
Right.
The housing market, right? The housing market is going to keep going higher. There's more people coming in. More people want houses. Immigration, whatever it is, the housing market is going higher. And suddenly, you're right. The calculation now is, do I need to cash out of my house right now? So this kind of moving away from, okay, let's figure out the macro picture. So, okay, what do I need? Is a big sea change for all of us to contemplate and to think about. Most of us are already doing it without even realizing it. We have started to think about my house and my cost of living and, you know, my mortgage and all this stuff, rather than, oh, what's the market going to do? Because I will then float along with the market. If I think the market's going higher, I'm fine. If I think the market is going lower, I'm not. Now it's a case of, okay, what do I do in my situation right now?
Great point. Well, look, and I'm looking at the time, Grant, and I'm realizing way more questions still left than we're going to have time to get through. So I'm going to try to be more precise here. Quick on this topic, layoffs and housing market, and maybe let's just jump up to recession first. Probabilities, again, we don't have perfect information. The big debate right now, as I said at the beginning, right, is soft landing or hard landing, right? And we've got the markets and we've got the Fed, funnily enough, on the same page there. Oh, soft landing. You look at the macro data, a lot of it seems to suggest hard landing. Yeah. Do you have a sense of your own personal calculus of whether you think we're going to have a recession this year? And if we do, whether it's going to be a light one or a harder one?
Well, let's flip that, because it's another really great question, but let's flip it through that prism we just talked about. The UK, yep. Last week, the headlines were UK just misses out on recession, right? Growth was 0.1 or whatever it was, right? So they didn't have those two quarters of falling growth, right? So UK just misses out on recession. Do you think anyone in the UK, from the perspective we've been talking about looking at their balance sheet and their house, and everything, do you think anyone has seen that and gone, coast is clear, right? I don't think they're not, because it doesn't really matter anymore, right? It doesn't matter that you missed a recession. You've still got 0.1% growth or 0% growth.
Well, that, and it doesn't matter what the technical definition of a recession is. Matters is how you feel in your life, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So if we do get a recession, and I'd be surprised if we didn't, but it's certainly not 100% baked in the cake. I'd be very surprised if we didn't go into recession this year. Could it be shallow? I can see a way for it to be, but that's not my base case. I think it might be deeper and longer than that kind of Goldilocks scenario. But it's really not going to change my thinking. If I look at the data and I look at what's happening from a bottom-up level, and you tell me, oh, the data suggests that we've avoided a recession. What does that mean when tech companies are laying off 10,000 people every single day, right? What does avoiding a recession mean? It doesn't mean anything in the real world sense. And that, I think, is the thing I keep hammering on this idea. But you know, the world as it used to be was headlines and macro and, oh, we're not in a recession and we've got growth and everything's great. Now it's the old joke about, you know, the difference between a recession and a depression is a recession when your neighbor loses his job and a depression is when you lose yours. And that's an important shift in mindset, because did we avoid a recession? Yeah, but tell that to the 250,000 people who've been laid off in the tech industry in the last month or two, right?
So I'm right there with you. And you know, maybe there's still some of the stimulus sloshing around the system that's letting people kind of keep going on fumes right now. And there's still some, you know, forbearance programs in place and stuff like that. But I look at the cost in essentials over the past couple of years, and they've been like double digit increases annually, right? And like, I knew tons of people 2-3 years ago that I would say couldn't handle that for a year. And yet we've had it now for sort of several years. And these baselines don't seem to be, you know, yes, maybe inflation might come down, but that doesn't mean that prices are going to stop going up as fast. It doesn't mean they're going to necessarily return to where they were. So we have this world. I've ranted on this program in the past, Grant, about like, you know, I live in a higher price area, but the cost of just like going out to an eatery has just exploded. Like you can't find a hamburger for under $20. Sure. I had to go buy some sandwiches for my wife's birthday the other day. And all in, the cost was $33 per BLT sandwich, right? So there's a point at which the consumer just says, I'm not doing it. You've hit my max pain threshold. I'm now substituting. I'm either going without or I'm downshifting to something else, right? And I know you're a big fan of sports. We just had the Super Bowl, which had the priciest Super Bowl commercials ever. But like sporting events have gotten so crazy that pretty soon at some point, the consumer just taps out and says, you know what, I'm just going to watch it on my TV, right? I don't need to pay $900 to send my family to go watch a ball game. I'll just watch it from home, right? And of course, that has big implications on consumer spending, right? And so you're talking about this at the individual level, people hitting their kind of limits. I agree with you. And I think the more people hit those limits, it's going to be really hard not to have more of a recession or the probability of recession not increase because people are saying, I just can't afford this anymore.
It's fascinating that you bring up sport, Adam, because this is something sport and the business of sport is something I spent an awful lot of time focusing on. I do a podcast, I'll give that a quick plug, called Are You Not Entertained? With a good friend of mine, Roger Mitchell, who used to be the chief executive of the Scottish Premier League football, and Giles Morgan, who was in charge of sports sponsorship for HSBC. And we've been doing this for a few years now, looking at all this huge money being invested in sport and the kind of tension between the billions being poured into sporting franchises and leagues and the rising costs for fans and what it's doing to fans and rubber meeting the road these last couple of years as people's, the price of eggs has doubled. Well, as you say, that being able to go to that game becomes less affordable, even if you used to go to 10 games a year and now you only go to 5. So you still get your fix of, the Yankees or, the 49ers or wherever it may be. It becomes a treat. And that ripples through, but sport has been this kind of last bastion of a pit that people can pour endless money into. I mean, I'm a big fan of the English Premier League, and we've just seen an extraordinary amount of money spent on soccer clubs. But does it? What does it mean in the real world? And again, I think it's the perfect place to look at this kind of macro picture and these people saying, well, if I get this club and the franchise and the value of the merchandise around the world, yada, yada, TV rights, yada, yada. And on the other side, you've got you, me, and every other sportsman in the world going, with hot dogs and popcorn, $500 to go to a Yankee game and sit in the bleachers. I'm just not going to do it. And that's, again, everything. I think the theme of this whole conversation, we keep coming back to this difference between bottom up and top down. And that's where I think the big shift has been, is that investors and private equity and hedge funds and oligarchs and Middle Eastern sovereign wealth funds are still looking top down, and the consumer has pulled away and is starting looking bottom up. And I don't think those gears have kind of meshed properly yet. I think there is still everyone's spinning. The top down are spinning and the bottom up are spinning and trying to figure out this new world. But they're going to realize when they both kind of get their heads around it that the gears don't touch anymore. There's a gap between them. And just as the same in the housing market, are you forced to lower your prices to meet the consumer, or is the consumer forced to pay more for things that they want? And obviously the difference is there's much more flexibility from the top down, the company that's making products. There's much more room because they can cut staff, they can use cheaper materials. They're all things they can do to lower their prices. It's tricky now than it has been a long time. But we come back to the hierarchy of needs. The consumer can't, once their mindset shifts from, I'm just going to get everything on credit, they can't just go, oh, well, I'm just going to go to the Yankee games, to hell with it. They just can't.
They have hard
it.
Limits. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's we're in a very interesting period right now where everything's kind of churning around and everything's changed, but I don't think we all realize how it's changed just yet. We don't realize how it's changed for us, and so we're making adjustments to how we do things, but I don't think the change in the big picture is as clear to people yet because it hasn't become clear.
Okay, great point. All right, well, look, in kind of beginning to wrap this up here, I want to get to sort of the type of future that you're preparing for, right? Because you said that as an investor, that's one of the things that you need to be doing right now, right? Is first getting your primary plan straight, right? And I would say, I'm painting with a broad brush here, but with the majority, if I look at the consensus of the folks that I've been interviewing recently, I'd probably synthesize it into the most probable path that the consensus opinion seems to project right now is, we'll have some sort of rally things will hang in there in the first half of this year. China opening, markets still, divorced from the data, you know, whatever, that'll last for some period of time. The China reopening surge will kind of moderate at some point, and then the data will probably start to win out over the market hopium. And then potentially that's when, you know, recession hits. And we haven't even talked about the lag effect from the 450 yeah. basis point of hikes that have already been done, hitting in full force, right? Because it takes them a while to manifest in the real economy, right? So it's sort of like, okay, things will hang in there for the first half of the year. They'll probably start to go off the rails at some point in the second half of the year. And then at some point, lo and behold, the Fed probably will be forced to pivot by some systemic crisis somewhere. And then we're going to see like a big central bank rescue. There'll be a policy reversal. There'll be lots of stimulus again and whatnot. Just love your reaction to that. Does that mesh with the consensus of what you're hearing? Do you think that there's another outcome that has a higher probability standpoint? And again, this is all going to change as we get more data.
Sure. I'm smiling because let's say you're absolutely right. Let's say that is what happens. What are you going to do with that information? What are you going to do with that roadmap you've just laid out?
Our interview with Grant will continue over in part two, which will be released on this channel tomorrow as soon as we're finished editing it. To be notified when it comes out, subscribe to this channel if you haven't already by clicking on the subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. And be sure to hit the like button too while you're down there. And if you haven't signed up yet for Wealthion's spring conference, which is coming up in just a month on Saturday, March 18th, head over to wealthion.com/conference and sign up for the conference there. Finally, if the challenging macro outlook that Grant has detailed in this interview has you feeling a little vulnerable about the prospects for your wealth, then consider scheduling a free, no strings attached portfolio review by a financial advisor who can help manage your wealth, keeping in mind the trends, risks, and opportunities that Grant has mentioned here. Just go to wealthion.com and we'll help set one up for you. Okay, I'll see you next over in part two of our interview with Grant Williams. We'll be right back.